Score, the podcast. The only show taking you inside the studios of the world's most celebrated composers and musical storytellers. Presented by Spitfire Audio.
Kenny Holmes and Robert Kraft.
With a motley crew. I mean, I think we have to...
Yeah, it's we're all here.
Share
we gotta take roll.
You gotta have a roll with butter.
Mash Raider here.
Mash Raider's in the room, and...
Composer Carol.
Hey.
Oh my God, that's like...
See?
She's that clearly energy. Had too many Red
this
Bulls.
This is sports...
Sport
what is wrong with... It's been a long weekend, okay?
Well, we
this is Score the Podcast, presented by Spitfire Audio.
Thank you.
We have a lot to get to. The Emmys were last night. Did I win? We're going to have to get into the numbers.
Well, first
here.
Of all, I want to just...
We have
put
conflicting
a little,
reports here, so we're going to have to go category by category and make sure.
Conflicting reports, and also, clearly we're not very good at math, because we have to add...
There's only seven.
There's seven categories, and we haven't been able to figure out who won.
By the way, and we also knew the answer to four of them for an entire week.
So, bear with us, as they say. I think we could actually just sum this up by saying, Robert won. I mean, we know this. We can get right to
who's
that point.
Who's we? When you say we.
I think
I was
it's
trying
probably...
to see if we had a cricket noise on the board, but I don't think we did.
We do now, though.
Big guest on the show one. Today, Emmy winner for Succession, Nicholas Britell, coming on in just a bit. Excited to talk with
he's
him.
He's awesome.
He is.
And perfect timing. I mean, we had him planned to come on the show. He comes to L.A. and swings by, grabs an Emmy, and then comes on the show.
Isn't that incredible? I wonder... how he gets his Emmy back home. He doesn't live in L.A. And it'll be interesting to hear how do you travel with an Emmy. They're big.
Good problem to have.
You know what? That's a quality problem. How do we do on our Emmy Awards?
Well, first, we want to tell you about our presenting partner because this show is made possible by our good friends at Spitfire
Audio. That's called a hook, what Robert just did.
Oh, yeah.
The audience is sticking around now.
A deep tease.
Stick around.
He's not the news producer, but well done on that, Robert.
I like that.
If you're a composer listening, you probably already know about Spitfire, but Spitfire makes sample libraries to elevate your music, different types of instruments to make your library grow, and you can... I mean, Carol, you use all kinds of Spitfire instruments. I know that.
Yeah, I do.
It's so great.
A lot of composers are all using these for mock-ups or sometimes for the final thing.
And they're recorded at Air Studios, one of the great studios in the world, not only in London, because that's where it is. It's just a beautiful church that George Martin, who produced the Beatles, converted into a world-class studio. That's where Spitfire creates a lot of their music. I know that they have relationships with Hans Zimmer, and I think they use the Bernard Herrmann library. Bernard Herrmann, who scored all the Hitchcock films. They sample and create libraries with his music. So,
and their latest big project, the BBC Symphony Orchestra package, which comes out in October 24th.
Yeah, that's going to be really cool.
So a lot to look forward to with Spitfire, and they're always coming out with new things. And they don't have sales very often, but for our listeners, we have an exclusive offer. Use the promo code SCORE, and you can save a third of the price. And some of these packages... They're jam packed and they can be pricey. So saving
jam-packed.
A third off.
Yeah, you can jam with them.
You can jam with them, certainly. Go to spitfireaudio.com, use the promo code SCORE.
33.3% off that retail
That's
price.
That's just what we do. We're trying to help
That's
the composer community out.
Correct.
And you can save just because you're listening to our show and our BS sometimes. We're happy to have Mash Raider back on the show this week so we can discuss
Where's the audience?
The outcome.
Everybody. Oh. Hey. Oh there. Thank you.
So let's get to the numbers. The big surprise of the night at the Emmys, which is kind of weird to say it was a surprise because every other year it was an obvious win, but Game of Thrones won the big prize of the night. And I got these outraged tweets from Mash Raider.
Nobody liked the end of Game of Thrones. Such a huge buildup that they botched. They botched it. They ruined it. And then they got to go up there in front of all their fellow writers and say, thank you so much. We did such a good job.
The big surprise of the night, the real overthrow at the Emmys was Fleabag.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, Veep.
They had a great night. They won three or four different Emmys.
Yep. Phoebe, who is Fleabag, taking home Best Actress. She wrote and maybe Best Comedy. And oh, in her spare time after winning for Fleabag, she is the writer of Killing Eve.
Hmm.
And so she just triumphed last night and surprised everyone. And
deserved. And that's a show that I don't think is coming back. I think that's it.
That's it.
Yeah, just two seasons.
Two and done.
Yep.
I loved the line from Bill Hader when he was introing the limited series. He's like, limited series or canceled series.
Oh, nice.
He's like, nobody wants to see season two of Chernobyl.
Kenny, you were actually at the Emmys, covering the Emmys on the purple carpet. What was up with the purple carpet?
That's a great question. I overheard one of the big wigs of the Academy saying that it just worked with the Fox color scheme, and it was a switch up. I don't know that there was any sort of cause or anything. It did look weird, though, when we first walked in. It was like,
Robert, any insight from your Fox peeps?
Definitely. Purple carpet, I can now reveal, is a tribute to Prince. And I think that...
Well, there you have it.
There it is.
That's a first on Score the Podcast.
We get our scoops, our Fox scoops from Robert, who still has... you have a nameplate up in the top floor of the building there?
It's actually the Robert... They say Robert Kraft presents the Fox Studios lot. I don't know if you've driven on recently, but my name is above the entire...
I don't think this is true, but...
Well...
If anyone can get proof of this and send a
picture. My imagination.
Kenny, do you talk to anybody interesting after either before or after they won their awards last night or Sunday night?
I think my favorite moment was we talked to Henry Winkler, who's always like the nicest guy in the world. And this was before. And he said that if he doesn't win, it's fine because he wants to share the love. And it's really cool because he won his first Emmy last year. But he said that he keeps his Emmy right by the front door. So anytime a package gets delivered, he can thank the driver and his Emmy and like start an Emmy speech again. He's like, "Oh, I just want to thank you so much," and he guides the eyes of the driver
award.
Over to his Emmy. So he's great. He's great, and we got to talk to a lot of people. Got to talk to some of the Queer Eye guys, which are hilarious, and I spoke with Lorne Michaels after he won another Emmy.
Oh,
saw Kyle Mooney and Beck Bennett, who I'm a big fan of the actors on. SNL. It was fun. It's exhausting though. People think like, "Oh, how cool," but it's hot. It's so hot. And you're wedged into a group of people and you just kind of have to throw elbows and
do we
get
have
in
a,
there.
A kind of a sad violin melody we can play at this point.
It's fun. It's fun to
is
be there
feeling
but
sorry
it's
enough
also,
for Kenny.
it is tiring, I will say. Yeah. So if that's why I can't even speak today, I'm just flubbing all over the place.
You know what? We are Flub the Podcast. It's our new sequel.
But I was stoked to see Jarrell.
Yes.
For When They See Us.
Oh, he's great. Good. Corey he's Wise.
Really Corey Wise. His that episode, the last episode, episode 4.
Genius.
That was just incredible.
And I'm just pleased that show got acknowledged because they were unfortunately in a category up against Chernobyl.
Yeah.
And
cool was that moment when he won and everyone stood and just like there were tears in everyone's eyes and they were clapping. There was a lot of excitement for him.
A lot of emotion.
And he was pumped. And also Billy Porter. That was exciting. For
amazing.
Pose. So it was a fun night. The show was a little awkward, if at best. The actual show, the non-hosting. They need to get a host.
Yeah. I actually am available next year, so it's something I'd like to just put out there.
We picked 7 categories.
Good.
We've already been through, we should be able to do the math easily on this, but we're just going to go through real quick through all of these. Main title theme music. Kenny and Robert both picked Succession, which won.
Yay.
Carol and I both screwed that one up.
Okay.
We lose. Oh, look at you with the buzzer.
Okay, so I'm just keeping count here. One. I have
Kenny
enough.
With the soundboard.
I have enough fingers. Go ahead.
Okay. All right. Music in limited series. Everybody but Robert.
Okay.
You're going to keep just that one finger up.
Right.
Everyone but Robert got points for Chernobyl. For Hildur. And music in series. Only Carol got it.
Nice.
Well done, Carol, with Ramin.
Ramin.
So are we keeping track of the scores
here?
I haven't moved my one finger. I'm waiting for another win. Come on.
Music in documentary, Free Solo.
Did I get
Marco Beltrami. And only Robert got it.
Damn. Okay.
Good, so good.
So what's our score through the Creative Arts Emmys?
Wait, I think I got confused here. Didn't we do this Also, last
and main
week,
title.
Yes.
Yeah, didn't we?
Well, but we're adding them now, so we're getting the
didn't
final
we have,
tallies.
Like the three of us, Kenny, Robert, and I, two, and Matt,
one.
Matt has one.
Good.
Yep.
Moving on.
So moving into the next week, because we all, Robert and I picked Nicholas Britell, Succession.
Correct.
Limited series, Kenny and yours truly, Mash Raider, picked Chernobyl, which was our big winner for limited series. Robert and Carol, unfortunately, no points.
Ooh.
So what's our tally? We have the two main categories left.
Kenny's leading. We have Kenny on three, Robert, Matt, and I are doing two.
Okay. Yeah. Well, so. I thought I only had one, so that's perfect.
Okay. No, because you had Chernobyl and Chernobyl.
Well,
yeah.
I think that's the only other one I got.
Is it too late to cheat?
Yes.
Think, okay, go ahead.
No, I'm standing by my
comedy.
Yes, yes.
The big winner of the night was Fleabag, and only Robert got that one. So that pulls Robert up to 3 points.
That was a big upset.
Big upset.
That was Veeps to win.
Yep.
So here's the deal. Dramas, the best drama went to Game of Thrones.
Yes,
which nobody picked.
Nobody picked.
So we end in an unsatisfying tie.
Between Kenny and Robert.
Right on.
Fight.
We need an extra category for something. I vote for...
Well, it's too late. It's got to carry on to the Oscars or something now.
Oh, darn. I was going to say...
I mean, if we go to last year, I'm still winning by a half.
Or rumor has it that this could be settled in maybe our finale episode of Name That Score.
Okay. I'll take my 3 points into the final episode of... Name That Score. And our category...
Not in this episode, but coming soon.
Coming soon.
Wow.
I'm worth waiting for.
Awesome.
Do we have Nick Britell?
We do have Nick Britell coming up. I do want to mention, too, because we spent a lot of time on Seinfeld earlier this season.
Yes,
and
yes.
It's also the 25th anniversary of Friends.
You're so right. How nice for the songwriters and the band. And
did you say you knew the writers of this song?
I know the writers well. It wasn't the Rembrandts. They're the band who cut the song. And God bless them. What a nice track to have on TV every week for the rest of your life. Many times a week in some cases. The writers were Michael Skloff, great piano player, arranger, and songwriter in L.A., and Allie Willis, who is arguably one of the biggest songwriters of pop and soul music.
She's any notable?
Oh, Allie wrote Boogie Wonderland for Earth, Wind, and Fire. She wrote The Color Purple musical that's on Broadway. She's written tons of hits for Chaka Khan and big artists, all kind of in the late 70s, early 80s. Allie is a legend, truly a legend, and she and Michael, it'd be interesting to get the story behind that song.
Do you think there's ever going to be shows like this again? I guess maybe Big Bang Theory is in the workings of trying to be at this level, but like Seinfeld and Friends, like is there going to be maybe
The Office?
The Office, I guess, is making its mark too at this point, but it's kind of now like all these shows from like the 90s and 2000s, They're being reintroduced into the streaming world and all these huge deals are being made. Do you think that's going to even exist anymore with the amount of content that's been coming out?
I wonder. I mean, it really comes down to how these shows are distributed, because there was a very understandable system in place. On Thursday nights on NBC, at 8 o'clock, you saw the next episode of a 30-minute sitcom. Now, okay, how do you do that on Netflix or Amazon or Hulu or Apple? Do you bunch them all up and you watch the whole thing on a Saturday and a Sunday?
And even the other series that are maybe in the same, you know, the It's Always Sunny type shows that are 14, 15 seasons in right now.
They're not nearly at that
They're
level.
Not the network. They're not what network was 15 years ago, you know, and having that number of eyeballs.
Well,
even though they do
of,
have huge audiences
back then, you didn't have that many options, and on like network TV in that time period,
correct,
that was the only thing people watched.
Yep.
I don't even think cable even have series in that time frame.
I don't even
Nothing notable, though. I mean, like USA, there was like Murder, She Wrote. And
probably the biggest
stuff like that. But
the right. biggest thing that showed up was in 84, the Fox Network came with Married with Children. And oh, that yeah. was suddenly there were four venues. There was no cable of note. CNN, you know, cable news network sort of showed up. Ted Turner. But it's just such a different landscape now.
Yeah.
Comedy's different. And
TV shows are films now. The budgets are massive.
Right.
For and, not just the actors, but for the sets.
And the opposite is also true. Films are TV shows. In other words, sometimes you go in with a film to a motion picture studio.
Like you just saw.
In which?
Downton Abbey.
Downton Abbey, exactly right.
Yeah. And the upcoming Breaking Bad movie.
The Breaking Bad movie.
Yep. I got my ticket.
I'm super excited about. Oh, yeah, you're going to see it in person.
Yeah, in theater. They're doing a limited theatrical, and they keep adding little screenings here and there. So if you're trying to go watch it in the theater, which I heard.
Which is October
11th.
11th.
Yep. Friday, October 11th. I'll be there. Downtown LA. I'm excited.
Right on.
And you said Downton did well at the box office.
Downton was, we had an interesting weekend this weekend. It was, I think, surprising to all the viewers of box office because traditional male centric and male movie star movies were eclipsed by a British drawing room comedy. So Downton Abbey crushed, almost doubled Ad Astra, which was Brad Pitt in space, and Rambo 11, whatever it was called, Sylvester Stallone. So
I feel like these are the elevator pitches in the room.
Right.
It's Brad Pitt in space.
Do you know what?
I think that's probably doing that. I've heard that's actually a good movie, Ad Astra.
It is, and I can't think of one executive in Hollywood, maybe with a few exceptions, that you wouldn't be in an elevator say, I got Brad Pitt in space, and say,
right.
when can you start? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just, you figure, that's a movie star. You can figure out that picture. Rambo... Not entirely sure what they're doing there, unless there's a secret Rambo audience that will see anything. Clearly, it's not as big as they anticipated, because Downton Abbey, which was wonderful. I mean, that's the best adjective I can think of. It is a wonderful movie. It's
well, people who haven't seen the series understand what's going on.
I actually talked to somebody after the movie yesterday, quite accidentally, who had seen it and said they loved the movie. So,
who hadn't seen it?
I hadn't seen the series. They saw the movie and they loved it. I think if you've seen the series, it's a little bit of bringing the old crowd back, and you kind of love
sure.
all the characters. One thing I must say, certainly from the perspective of Score the Podcast, the music is absolutely magnificent in the movie, and it's even... You know, the show is cinematic. The movie is really a widescreen affair, and it's beautiful, huge kind of vistas of beautiful green England and the countryside, and the music brings that out. So altogether, a wonderful experience. I recommend it.
I'm cool. Feel so relaxed after that explainer.
Soothing, Robert, soothing voice.
So then we're going to go into Ad Astra, where it's all anxiety and tension.
Brad Astra.
Brad, not bad.
I just came up with that. On that note, I think we should...
Yeah, that was definitely a good one.
That was a really good one, Brad.
Matt,
Astra.
Do you have any closing more complaints about Game of Thrones? This is your last chance because it's over.
Yeah.
Winter is here.
I'm ready for it to be over. Can we let it end? Let's let it end. Let's never speak of this again.
What should have won?
I mean, honestly... What should have won is probably Better Call Saul, because every episode is its own movie, and it's thought out in three acts in a very cinematic way. It's shot artfully. It's nonverbal and visual storytelling. It's great acting all around. Everything is superb. So if it were up to me, and if campaigning wasn't such a big part of the Emmys process and all the other factors that go into a campaign, I would have given it to Better Call Saul.
And I think... We can wrap it up by going like this.
Matt's cringing.
My ears.
Oh, no.
Thank you very much. We wait till the Emmys next year. Unfortunately, nobody watched the Emmys, so it doesn't matter. They did terribly. They did terribly. So not a big viewership, way down this year.
And welcome to the people that have skipped through this first block about yes. the Emmys.
I think we're on to Nicholas Britell.
But speaking of the Emmys, coming up after the break, did he bring it with him? I don't know. Nicholas Britell is joining us. He has
the Emmy
for main title theme for Succession and a lot more to talk about, new projects coming up, and two Oscar nominations that we're going to talk about as well. Stick around.
Cool.
Nick Britell is up next.
Hey, Matt Schrader here, director of Score, a film music documentary. For the latest news from the film music world, follow us on Facebook. Just search Score, a film music documentary. Or let us know who you want to hear next on the show on Twitter, at Score the Podcast.
Welcome back to Score the Podcast, presented by Spitfire Audio. We are stoked right now for our guest. I'm such a fanboy of Succession. And we've been trying to make this work. Nicholas Britell joining the show. Nick, thanks so much for coming on.
I'm so excited to be here.
Are you hungover? I mean, you just won the Emmy.
I'm not hungover. I feel great.
Oh,
I
good.
Feel great. Yeah. I was a little hazy the next day, but just from being disoriented.
Did you party like a rock star till 8 a.m. the next morning?
I wish I could say we did. We didn't really. We were there. There's a great governor's ball after the ceremony, and we were there till, you know, it was very, very reasonable, like till like 11 or something like that.
I think the first question that you're asked after a win like that is, where is the Emmy?
The Emmy is back at the hotel room.
Back at the hotel room.
Yeah. And it's, you know, the Emmys are, it's large and it's heavy. And when you we have to go back to New York, and they give you like this huge traveling box,
which is carry on, or do you have to tag it and stow it.
I need to explore that this week.
You got to walk through security with that thing.
I think it has to be carried. There's no way you check that. I think so. I have to explore.
And then
that,
then you get the cool pat down where they're like, "Hey, pull that out. What is that?"
It's sharp, by the way. It's sharp. The point, there's very pointy parts on the
Nicholas Britell was arrested at LAX.
It's dangerous though. You're holding. It's like, watch out where you're pointing.
A TSA agent. I would say that carrying your Emmy from Los Angeles to New York is the definition of a quality problem. That's got to be
It's like a $50 fee too, right? Extra bag for that thing?
I don't know. I will keep you guys posted.
Because this is your first Emmy, correct?
Yes.
It is your first Emmy. Of course, Nick, who I've had the pleasure of working with, and we're going to have some great time talking about our wonderful collaboration together, which is historic, I think, on many levels. But you also, of course, nominated for Moonlight and Beale Street, both with Barry Jenkins, who I believe you're about to start a TV series with, correct?
We have started, yep.
Oh, you've started it. Yep. I can tell you a couple things. One of my favorite books, Underground Railroad.
Amazing.
I just
book.
Loved it. And one of my favorite authors, Colson Whitehead, actually have bought and haven't started The Nickel, which I believe is his new book.
Nickel Boys, I believe.
Nickel Boys,
yes.
Correct. And so when you say you've started, meaning the series is in production now?
Yes. Yes. And I've started working. We're starting to brainstorm things. But, you know, one of the great things, and we can talk about this, you know, at length, is when I work with Barry, we usually start talking about things even before production has begun. And there's sort of an initial kind of brainstorming, very, you know, just finding his initial feelings and instincts on things. And then it's a great process of seeing what those early kind of ideas are and then how they evolve. And Underground Railroad, too, there's some music that's actually in the world of the characters, some on-camera music that I'm helping explore.
Period music?
Yeah, some period music. You know, it's an interesting story. So there's interesting
things. A wonderful evocation of both the historic events and also a lot of kind of sort of the hyper reality of things that could happen.
Exactly.
Magic reality. I once read, correct me if I'm wrong, that you started working with Barry and he hadn't heard your music yet.
I didn't know this at all.
How is it possible that a director hires you without hearing you? You just had a good vibe?
It's a good question. I mean,
I love the way you spell your name.
I did not know. No, he told me we were doing an interview for If Beale Street Could Talk last year, and it was a podcast with Deadline, I believe. And we were we were talking, and all of a sudden he's like, I don't know if I told you this, but I had never heard your music when I hired you. And I did not know that at all. I assumed, so the way that I first met Barry was I was working with Adam McKay on The Big Short, and the producers of The Big Short, two of the producers, Jeremy Kleiner and Dee Dee Gardner, I had worked with before on 12 Years a Slave. Mm. And one night that summer, I was having dinner with Jeremy, and he started telling me about this incredible script that he was producing, and he got really emotional talking about it. And he said, it's called Moonlight. And I asked him if I could read it. And when I read it, I was just blown away by it. It was, you know, I've said this before, but it felt like a piece of poetry. It was, is the most beautiful script I'd ever read. Mm. And I asked Jeremy, I was like, is there any way I could meet Barry? You know, I'd love to talk to him. And so we met at the bar at the Ace Hotel in downtown LA. Yeah. And we were initially just meeting for coffee. And then we ended up having this like multi-hour conversation over wine where we were talking about movies and life and music and everything. And it was from that initial conversation that we just, you know, we just started exploring these ideas together. And that was how we started working together. And so the whole time, you know, then we worked together Moonlight. And then, you know, I was lucky enough to, you know, they asked me back to work on Beale Street. The whole time I'd always assumed that before that early meeting that Jeremy might have sent some of my music or anything, you know. And Barry just said that he liked talking to me that first day.
That's incredible.
And I was like, that, you know, and I honestly, I don't even know who to, thank my lucky stars, I guess, that was
isn't that
possible.
Like half the battle, though, is having that connection? Because I feel like even if he loved your music, if he didn't get along with you, that's a worse problem.
I think that was his, you know, and 100% agree with that. It's because the process of film music especially is so collaborative. I mean, I really believe there's no way to do it without that kind of a close collaboration, because that's actually what the job is. You know, it's not, let me watch this interesting project. Let me see what you're working on. And then let me go off and bring you things. You know, that's not what this is. Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, it's possible to do it that way. I can't conceive of doing it that way just because it just feels like the key is about this connection, not just with the work, but with the people who have made this work, you know, and understanding what they are hoping for and what they're hoping to feel. Because that's, I think that it's a very intangible kind of thing that happens. And it's through these conversations where it's actually a very intimate process where, you know, you're sitting with somebody, they come and they're sitting on your couch, and, you know, you're asking questions, like, you know, really deep questions of not just like, what do you feel, but what is the deep underlying emotion that we are seeking here, those kinds of questions. And so without that, I think you're right, without that kind of rapport, it would be very difficult, I think, to get to those places.
I think I just understood something about film scoring hearing you say that, which you'd think I would have, maybe I realized it before, but for the kind of films particularly that you've worked on, it sounds almost obvious, but you have to go through that process of collaboration and intimacy because you are the musical voice for the director and for the story, and you have to really, to have it be accurate and first class, you need to have every granular detail about their emotions, the emotions in the story. It may be slightly different for some kind of programmed movies that are action movies that it's really, you need to hit the beats. But in the movies that you've been doing, you're inside these characters. And I realized you have to understand what Barry wants to express and do it for him.
Absolutely.
Because he can't compose the music.
And he loves music. I mean, that's the thing. I think a great starting point for this kind of a relationship is if the director loves music, you're already ready for a successful partnership. I think the only tricky times really come when someone maybe subconsciously doesn't really love music or doesn't really love how music and movies work together. That's where it gets difficult, because then I think there are other almost like more existential questions that arise from the type of work that you're trying to make, which can be important too, because again, it goes back to the question of what does the director want? That's really what it is. And so for example, like, you know, I don't want to write a score for a film that the director doesn't love. You know, it's not about me. It's not something that I'm saying, oh, this is I think this is right. We have to do that. You know, it's much more like, what do you really want? And how can I then take that and believe in it from my own, you know, sensibility? But it's really about tailoring it to their wavelength. You know, that's what it is. It's not, you know, if we couldn't figure that out, then I wouldn't want to do it.
Listen up, aspiring composers.
Yeah, well,
that's the number one thing.
But it's about them being happy, like, you know. Yeah.
I think you can share with the perspiring composers who are listening what happens. Maybe this has happened to you before, when what the director wants is wrong. And I say that because it takes either a great amount of internal dialogue on your part to say, maybe it isn't wrong. Maybe it's just my expectation for that is different. Or you have that really strong feeling that either what you'd written is exactly what it needs, or leaving something out there where he wants music. Have you developed chops for dealing with those dissonances?
Are you a good salesman?
Well, you know, I think the key, you know, at the end of the day, it really is about the film that the director wants to make. It has to be. Yeah. And it's not, you know, I didn't make the movie. And we really are in service of the director and the producers and the creative team. So I think, you know, the most important thing to do is, if you do believe in an idea, you should express that, and you should keep presenting that idea.
Yeah.
You know, there are times where, you know, because I think the key thing that I think about a lot is, you know, I don't actually want to have to convince somebody to put it. I never want to, like, win an argument and get a piece of music in a movie. Oof. I never, because, you know what, like, that's who wins there. Nobody wins, you know, like, then I've somehow, like, you don't want to push something through. You want it to be something that they actually want, because then it resonates with their vision for the project. And so the last thing you want is to actually try to, like, push through things.
So you've never, like, thrown down, had a hissy fit, and said, dude, I'm right, you're wrong.
But here's the thing, there could be, you know, but here's the thing. Ultimately, it's an aesthetic question. It's this question of, like, I could think that there's something so beautiful for a particular place, but maybe then I'm actually looking at the film from through the wrong lens, you know? And there are a lot of times I would flip it and say, there are actually a lot of times where I've written something that I thought was really beautiful, and then the director said, that's not how I see this at all. And they've been completely right. And by being fluid with that, you wind up in a much better place. And then each project, you're sort of, like, learning as you go. Like,
that's wonderful.
I don't want to be, you know, I think we do this because we want to be excited by the next project. We want to learn on the project. We want to try new things. You know, if it was the same kind of thing every time, and you were just sort of like, oh, if I do this, then this happens, I think it would get pretty boring.
Yeah.
But I mean, for me, one of the best examples of that was the swimming sequence in Moonlight, where I wrote this piece called The Middle of the World, where Juan is teaching Little to swim.
This is Mahershala out in the ocean.
Exactly. And it's chapter one of Moonlight. And I remember I wrote a piece that I thought was, you know, this is already after early on, the medium length version of the story is basically that early on, after I read the script, the first question I was really trying to figure out for myself was, what is this? The movie and the script felt poetic to me. And, and I was trying to channel this idea of, like, what sound of music could create this feeling of poetry. So I was early on, you know, I was writing pieces, like, I wrote a piece of music and I called it Piano and Violin Poem. And it was a demo I did, piano and Tim Fain on violin, who you know Tim.
Of course.
And so what I did was early on, this was that, and then I got the early cuts of Moonlight and I sent it to Barry. And that piece, Barry felt really connected with the film, and the demo of that piece is Little's theme. That is the sort of point of view.
That actual thematic. Recording? Did the you
actual,
re-record it?
The actual recording. It's just me and Tim.
Sometimes you just get it.
There's and that was something that Barry felt very strongly about, was that he wanted everything to feel human. He wanted everything to feel like real instruments. And you know, I can go in more depth on that. But what happened was, so for the swimming sequence, which is still in chapter one of the film, I was thinking, okay, Little's theme's in D major. I'm going to do something, you know, it's going to be more full. This is a scene that, you know, I was thinking this is a beautiful moment in Little's life where Juan is teaching him to swim. You know, your open sky, you see this, it's very, almost like a sort of a grand, warm feeling. So I put it in F major. It was going to be more orchestral. So that's what it became. What I wrote was not this initially. I wrote something that was very happy, and it actually was Little's theme, but with a clarinet playing Little's theme. And I played it for Barry, and he was just like, no, 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 not at all, no. And what he said to me was, he said he wanted the scene to feel like a spiritual baptism.
Oh.
You know, this isn't, we're not taking the emotional feeling of, it's not just happiness. This is actually the beginning of the rest of Little's life. This is a very, very significant symbolic moment, and we need to feel a bit of what is to come, actually, not just, so instead of thinking sort of micro, here's this one moment, it's much more macro of what is the whole sweep of this film.
Do you remember how you felt at the end of that conversation? Were you crushed that your work hadn't been approved and signed off on, or were you resigned to the fact that you needed to go back into the workshop?
Well, Barry and I work in, you know, he was in, we were in the studio, we were going to try to figure this out together. And that was, and actually when he said that, it completely made sense to me. And I saw the sequence in a very, very different way right away. And that's one of the fun things with film music, is that depending on what the music is in a particular place, the scene completely changes. I mean, it's totally, actually like, yeah, a magical, bizarre thing that I don't think I'll ever fully understand how it happens, where like you can put a different piece of music up and all of a sudden you're watching a completely different movie.
Different emotions.
Everything's different. You see the scenes. So when Barry said that, I was like, okay, we have to, you know, I'm going to go D minor. I'm going to, and I had,
so
this.
You were on a keyboard there? Playing
in my studio. We were in my studio. Fabulous. Yeah, we were looking at the scene, and I said to him, you know, I had always, I've always loved the sound of, these sort of violin arpeggios. And I had this idea of, well, what if I tried to create something that felt more in that emotional world? And I started exploring these violin arpeggios with a, you know, using a violin sample sound in front of Barry. And I started playing this, and right there, he just started directing me. He was like, keep going with that, keep going with that. And so I just kept going with it. And I basically wrote it right there in front of him. And then I wrote out the music for it. And Tim Fain wasn't in New York at the time, so I emailed him the sheet music. And I said, you know, can you just take a look at this? And Tim's amazing because, you know, he's just a phenomenal musician, phenomenal violinist. And usually the stuff that I would give him, if he's in the room with me or wherever, you know, he'll be like, oh yeah, no problem, let's do this right now. And I remember when I sent him that sort of like cadenza, he was like, you know, give me a couple of days on this one.
Oh, wow.
Sounds difficult.
So it's really, yeah, it's you know, it's a bit involved. It's definitely playable, but it's a bit involved. And but that was how that happened. So for me, I always think back on that moment, because it wasn't just a question of like, oh, you know, here's what I did and here's where we wound up. It really was a question of going into that bigger perspective of what is this scene really about? And why, like, why are we putting music here?
Well, what a privilege to hear Barry Jenkins come forward to say, this is the bigger idea.
Absolutely.
As an artist.
Absolutely.
And I think that's getting the opportunity to collaborate with artists that way and hear their, you know, that's interesting, but it's actually a bigger moment for me in this way. It's just, it's inspiring. It's got to be a great, one of the great joys of the gig.
It's the whole thing. I mean, I think being able to have that feeling of discovery where you're in the room together with a director and you figure something out and you find something. And I've loved those opportunities with Barry, because we know what that feeling is. And every time we're working, we know it's there and we know it's possible, and we don't stop until we find that. So like on Beale Street, the same kind of thing happened, with the score elements that focused on the sense of injustice in the story. I had written, Barry's first thing that he said to me was about, he thought that the movie could have this sound of brass and horns. Mm-hmm. That was the first thing he said. He didn't say anything more than that. It was just this sort of world of brass and horns. And so I started exploring that with trumpets and flugelhorns and French horns and, you know, trying some different things out. And the world that was created from that initially was this more of the world of love, because the movie really focuses on love and mm-hmm. in all its forms. But there was this sense of very clear and overt injustice, obviously, in the film and in the story. And in those sequences that focused on that, in some of the places, there actually wasn't score when we were, at least when we were first mapping it out. It was almost a question of, like, what is the sound of that, and how do you do that justice to that injustice, you know, emotionally and musically? And so, for example, there's a sequence where the character Daniel is talking to Fani and telling him about his experience in prison. And you are, and when I first saw the scene, it's just an incredible scene. And there was a Miles Davis, Blue and Green, is playing on the record player.
Fantastic.
And, you know, when we first watched it, I remember saying to Barry, I was like, are we thinking, should we put something here? Or, and Barry was like, you know, we got Miles, like, yeah. hard to argue with Miles here, yeah. You know? And I always would agree with that. Yeah. But however, that was one of those moments where I, for some reason, in the back of my mind, I was like, I think there could be something to do. So we focused on other parts of the film. And I remember there was a week, I think it was like April of last year, where we were in the studio together in my studio in New York. And I just kept coming back to it. I was like, you know, I think there's something we could do here. Like, can we just try something? And what's wonderful about Barry is he always says, show me.
Okay.
You know, he will never say, don't try. Right. It's all, you know, it may not work, but, you know, 100 things might not work, you know, so we always try it out. And I remember what I did was I started taking the cellos that are in this piece Eros that you hear when Tish and Fani are first making love. Mm. And I took those and I just started like distorting them and bending them and lowering them and taking the audio itself and just like bending it. And it started to create this really frightening sound that almost sounded like, I mean, I think to us it almost sounded like a machine that was being like warped, and it just sounded horrific. And that was one of those moments where, you know, Barry and I sort of looked at each other and we're like, and you know, he's like, keep going with that.
Oh, wow.
And so we started doing it. And what ended up happening was we created this soundscape for those moments of injustice where the sounds of love in other parts of the film are harmed and distorted. So you're hearing basically the same thing that is beautiful in this other place, but the music has now been, you know, warped and almost like there's an attempt to like destroy this sound of love. And that's what you hear in those moments of injustice. And we, you know, again, that was one of those feelings for us where we were, you know, for days we worked on this, and at the end we were just like, what just happened? Like, where did we, and we said to ourselves, like, we have to like almost like live with this a little bit. Cause we were like, is this almost too, like, it's so different from what we had before. So we had to give ourselves a little time to,
I assume it got better the more you lived with it and felt righter.
Yeah.
It's interesting that you are striking all this gold with the director in the room, where a lot of composers don't want people in the studio when they're writing. Is this something that you find to be helpful?
I love working with a director in the room. Yeah. I feel, I mean, I do a lot of work with, you know, before the director comes too. I think it's really important to be prepared with, you know, to have your own sensibility, your own set of experiments that you want to try out, but those experiments you can't try out unless you're with the director. So, you know, it's almost like you have a list of like hypotheses of like, these are, you know, this is one idea that could go, and then we would wind up over here, you know, but, or maybe this could be interesting. And if we do that, I kind of have a sense, well, we might wind up over here. But you know, so you don't, I don't want the director to come over and then I have, you know, and then we're just like, what do we do? I don't think that's necessarily
helpful.
Do you
actually tap in your pencil?
Yeah, yeah. We're just like, oh,
what do you think,
see if
man?
It happens. Yeah, yeah.
6 hours go by.
We don't do that.
Do you play live? Do you make extensive demos to play? Do you do both when
the
director
play live.
Comes over?
Well, if it's stuff, yeah, usually I will have recorded things beforehand to try out, but depending on what the director's feeling from those recordings or from those ideas, I'll absolutely play live and try things out and just extend them. Or, you know, I mean, some of the my favorite things I've done has been directly moment to moment from a director or, you know, someone saying, hey, what about this?
It's so great to have the guy in the room who you need to work with and express to go right to
get the immediate reaction.
What's better than that? What's better than that?
You don't waste your time.
No, and also it's about the creative result we're going for, because I just know, and again, this is my own kind of process, but if I doing stuff over email is really, really hard. Doing stuff long distance is really, really hard. And I don't think that that doesn't say anything about the relationship itself. It just says the fact that distance is hard for everything. And if you're not in the same place, I mean, there are 500 ideas you could try out in an hour. And those 500 ideas to try those out over email would take you 50 years.
Oh yeah, I'll check it in 30 minutes. Like,
you would never, you would never even begin to get through them.
Yeah,
and I felt that most strongly. I remember the first time I'd ever had that kind of a iterative process up close was on The Big Short. It was with Adam McKay and Hank Corwin, our incredible editor. I had come on to the film in May of 2015, April, May.
Was that your first one with Adam?
It's the first project with Adam. Yep. Yeah. And
such a good movie.
Oh, thank you. Adam is amazing. You know, he's brilliant. He's the funniest person I've ever met, for sure. You know, I remember one of the first conversations we had, you know, I was going to come out to LA and meet everybody. And when they were setting me up, it was a Paramount film, and Paramount was fantastic to work with. And we were doing post in the Technicolor building mm-hmm. on the Paramount lot. Yep. And so they were going to give me a little, office studio space where I could write. And the first day I got there, Adam and Hank were working in their edit suite. And they were just like, you know, you want to just come and watch some stuff with us and sit here and we'll just like talk. And I was like, yeah, sure. Let me see, you know, get a sense of the movie. So as we started doing it, I remember Hank was editing this one part and I just said, oh, you know, I think there's something cool we could do with that. Do you want to try it out? And Hank was like, sure. I mean, do you want to bring your laptop in here and maybe the keyboard and we'll just see what happens? So I just brought some stuff in there as Hank is like editing, I'm just like playing stuff along as if it's almost like, you know, live to picture. And we kind of looked at each other and we're just like, this is pretty great. If we could keep doing this for the whole summer.
Did any of that make it?
Absolutely. Like,
and did you move
absolutely? Oh yeah.
Did you move your keyboard in?
I ended up I was basically in both places. And whenever there was a particular moment, they would just say, hey, Nick, can you come in here? And
nothing better.
It was incredible. And so we had this, you know, that was a situation where literally I was like living there. I was living with the McKay's family, actually, the McKay family the whole summer in their little pool house, which was wonderful. They're incredibly hospitable. and
talk about, you know, connecting.
We were like immersed. No, we were completely immersed while we were
like,
working.
Can you pass
that.
The syrup? And yeah. What do you think about this cue right now?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And it's like, oh, yeah, what do you think about this? Like, Adam loves movies. I mean, he loves movies. And so we would just talk about movies all the time. We'd watch movies. I remember, you know, at the end of the day, we would like, you know, order some pizza and a little champagne, figure something out and just like watch a movie together. You know, it was great. It was the best. So, but that process of being up close and trying things out was a complete revelation to me because it was the most heightened version of that kind of collaborative process. And I think from experiencing it up close and seeing what's possible from that, it changes the way you view all, you know, why wouldn't you want to. That's the ideal, is like you're literally in the edit room. That's not always going to happen. And on different projects, that may not be the right thing either. But if you think about the most sort of, you know, extreme version of that, and then the maybe the golden mean version of that is like you're in your studio and the director's there and you're trying things out together. And it's not like you're living in the edit room. But that's, I think, the sort of that's like the optimal way.
I think it's so.
It's also
ideal.
A sign of a good connection with the director if they want you in there. There's a lot of trust there.
Yeah, and it's so helpful for the I mean, you know, seeing the types of questions that they're asking themselves moment to moment about the movie that they're making within 15 minutes, you have a completely different
Let me get this straight.
View,
so directors aren't completely secure about every decision they make?
It's a converse. Everyone's trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
You know, everyone. I mean, and that was the thing that Adam always would say when we were working. And I think about it on every project now. It's like, he would always say, the movie's going to win in the end. You know,
nice.
It's, we got, you know, and which means like, you're trying to make the best movie possible. It's all about the movie. It's not about any of us, you know? So if someone has a cool idea and it makes the movie better,
it's so generous.
That idea.
That is so generous. I've certainly known directors that want to make sure they've actually come to me as the movie's wrapping. Mm. They shall remain nameless and said, you know, I was really involved in a couple of these cues, kind of helping our composer. Do I get credit on those, and I'd always have to say, it's an interesting idea. You're the director, so you get credit on everything.
It's your movie.
Yeah, it's your movie. But I have been asked a couple times for, you know, how does that work? Do you get co-writing credit if you told the composer, I don't think it should be horns, I think it should be a rock band, and they did it, and it worked? I'm just wondering. You know, I'd say, you're the director.
But that is the thing. That's part of the director credit, is knowing that that is the role for every department, actually.
Costumes,
I think that's the beauty of that role, is that the director makes the choices essentially for every department.
Correct.
And, I think that's something that when you're working on these films, you see it up close, that, like, I think the role of the director is about choices. It's about all the departments bringing their best ideas and their best instincts. And then ultimately it's the director who's going to choose of all those ideas, which direction are we going in?
And he either gets the kudos or takes the bullet for making those choices.
Boy, that was a jam-packed first block there.
Incredible.
We're gonna take a quick break,
okay.
And we wanted to ask you about your path into film scoring.
Oh, but sure.
We jumped right into all these great films. It was like riveting. We're gonna take a break. Coming back with a lot more with Nick Pertell right after this. Hey, Score fans, it's Kenny Holmes. We're back to the show in just a second. Just a quick reminder: be sure to follow us on Twitter @ScoreThePodcast. We post a lot of behind the scenes videos, and we'll also keep you up to date on who our next guest is. So make sure to go over and follow us now.
Hi, my name is Hildur Guðnadóttir, and you're listening to Score the Podcast. Let's go back to the show.
And the Emmy goes to Succession, Nicholas Britell.
Welcome back to Score the Podcast, presented by Spitfire Audio. The Emmy-winning cut right here with the now Emmy-winning composer, Nicholas Britell.
I listened to this with Kenny a couple days ago, and I said, I don't know why it gives me a little stomach ache to hear this, because the emotions in the series and the emotions that you express right here, it's somewhere between tragic. It hits a moment of tragedy and of kind of melancholy for me. It might just be the way I'm hearing music.
For sure.
And
there's so much packed into this theme.
It's a lot there.
It's like, it's kind of regal and rich, but then it's also street with the beat, and you kind of see the dad and the kids and the drugs and the drama. I mean,
the tennis, there's a moment where they're rich. And of course, I, as you know, having worked at a studio that was run by a family, I see this whole series in a very particular way. I need to ask you a couple questions about the music we're listening to.
Sure.
First
please.
Of all, this is for composers who will understand this word. It doesn't feel quantized in the beginning. It feels very human and live. And I thought, which means to those of us who are musical, we're so used to right now hearing very perfect iterations of music. The drums are on time, the bass and the piano.
Or how about the three piano hits instead of two? That's my favorite part.
I love
cling,
that.
Cling, cling.
It's like I was trying to do that, and actually that was, there's a whole process of kind of doing this sort of thing, but I was trying to think of it as almost like if a DJ was playing that in a club there, you'd have that kind of a loop where you'd actually like bring it back and then come back.
I think that's what's fascinating about the theme, is it feels instantly a little unsettled. That's what I got from the very first time I heard it. I thought, wow, Nick decided a couple things. First of all, he decided that the piano feels almost kind of like a guy's playing it. It's not a very up and down synthesized. The rhythm track feels like there's kind of shaker or tambourine.
There's sleigh bells. There's a whole
So it's not what I expected for Succession, which would be a really slick. These guys are kind of slick and helicopters and mansions. It felt kind of melancholy and weird. The other amazing thing is to hear that cue and that tune come back in different
The variations.
Orchestrations. I realized, so you found a piece of music that, of all the choices for the theme, you decided to go with the one that starts with drums and piano and rhythm, but I also hear the theme in very different treatments.
I mean, is anyone going to rap on this? You gonna working on any
Come
collaborations?
On. Gucci
we'll,
Mane.
We'll see. We'll see.
It's really, it's elegant. That's, it's regal in a way of a family drama. That's where the tragedy comes in, as I feel the kind of tragic. Can you just, for a fan and the fan in me, what day did you write Succession theme? What had you read or seen or thought about?
Yeah, did
or,
it come right to you?
Or talked how, about that know, made you think, oh, I know what this is. Well,
it's interesting. This is actually a variety, like that. So this main title theme track was, as a totality, it was the last thing I did on the,
oh,
on
wow.
season one. Yeah.
It's like writing the big single
so
just as
it
the
was,
record's coming
out. I don't think, I know, I couldn't have written that before the scoring the
So you
show.
Scored the show.
So basically, I
pilot?
Had an early idea. Yeah, so I worked on the pilot. No, so it was even longer than that. I worked on the pilot. And again, that was one of the wonderful things. I'd worked with Adam already. He told me about Succession. He told me he was directing the pilot. And then I had a little time to think about it. And I even, you know, I visited set while they were, you know, making the pilot. And I got to meet Jesse Armstrong and we started a conversation. Nice. Jesse Armstrong created the show and is the showrunner of the show. And I did kind of what I was saying before. You know, I started exploring some different ideas, some different possible directions that I thought maybe would be interesting for the show. And I met with, it was very specific. We had a meeting with Jesse where I started playing him some of these ideas, and there was a whole range of things. And basically all of the things in their own way got into the series. There was some of the first stuff I remember in the pilot. There's like a scene where someone comes into an office and he's like saging the room, you know? So I remember, you know, I guess the feeling I always had was I wanted there to be this strangeness in the musical landscape. It's just, there's this incredible combination of darkness and gravitas and absurdity in the show.
Correct.
And so you know, you're trying to do both of those things, but you have to do it in a way where you're not harming either one of those extremes. So I remember one of the first things I played in was these, I had these like Zen bell sounds that I was taking and like bending and making them all sort of weird. And like someone would walk in a room and you hear a little weird bell, just strange, but kind of funny and odd. And Jesse was totally into that. And then I started playing him some early ideas, you know, this chord progression, which you now hear
is it
the film. It's this sort of, it's sort of 1/6, you know, and it's like a two,
it's a six minor
half. It's a half diminished, half diminished.
Is the,
there's a suspension five into the five and then back to the one. And so, you know, that kind of a progression and some of these early piano sounds and this idea of these beats, you know, I started playing him some beats with this stuff and he was into this kind of stew of ideas. And I remember the first thing that we really explored together, there was, I took some of those ideas and then I started playing with string sounds with some of those chords. And you never exactly know this alchemy of how these things happen, but I remember I started playing those chords with strings, and immediately it just felt like specific to the series somehow. It felt like this dark string sound and very low, a lot of low end. You know, that was something that was very important. In particular, for example, a lot of the season one stuff is in C minor, and you know, if you know with like double basses, I mean that low C is the low note there. So you're getting to that low, you're in a key that the lowest, that the normal tonic bass note is the lowest you can basically go, you know, otherwise you'd be basically going up.
Kind of like the Roy family. They go,
there's a dark, there's a low, there's a low end, you know?
Yeah.
And I always, I mean, I'm a massive hip hop fan and that low end, the sound, the, you know, and interestingly on Moonlight, that's a whole other kind of conversation, but one of the things that we had explored was this idea of chopping and screwing the music I was writing using that style of Southern hip hop where I took my own recordings and slowed them and
can you explain
them.
For our audience what chopping and screwing is? Because it's something you've referred to and used in your scores.
So chopping and screwing is, it's a style of hip hop. One of the great pioneers, DJ Screw, who would, you'd take a, it's if you take a recording and you basically slow it down, the pitch goes down. And when the pitch goes down, you get this deepened, enriched soundscape It's just everything is sort of widened and richer. And you can do that with any piece of music, but if you do it with beats and things, like, everything gets deeper and richer. And on Moonlight, in one of the first conversations I'd had with Barry, he talked about his love of chopped and screwed music. And we had this kind of idea of, well, what if I were to write music for, and this was before he had shot the movie, I mean, this was way early. It's like, what if I wrote a score, and what if we applied that technique to my classical sort of oriented composition for this? And that's one of those ideas that, again, it's an interesting idea, could work, could be terrible, could not work at all, you know, you don't know. And we started doing these experiments early on when I was actually working with an early cut, and it did work. It actually, it provided this whole sense of development for the music, where in addition to different thematic elements, you know, music as just music in a way, in addition to just sort of changing the type of music, by actually changing the music and changing literally the way the recordings were. So you're also, like, there's the other dimension where you're bending the recordings you're making in different ways. It felt to us like that accomplished the development of Little's own evolution throughout the film. And one of the, you know, going back to the Succession, one of the sonic results of that was that you ended up with this classical, quote unquote, more orchestral kind of sound that actually was lower than you would normally hear. You know, you had this, like, sub layer where, you know, you have cellos that are sounding in, like, the bass range just because you've bent them. And I thought that sounded beautiful. And so on Succession, I've always been a fan of the low end of the sonic range, but it was important to focus on that low end. And I think that one of the keys for me in scoring Succession was this, the darkness and the seriousness of it, because it's a very serious, you know, the fundamental of the story is it's basically about these increasing concentrations of power and wealth among, you know, smaller and smaller groups of people. And Succession focuses on families, you know, in the media industry, but obviously the story translates to any, you know, any type of industry really, and focuses on that, what happens with those extreme concentrations of wealth and power. So that's all in very serious subject. It's one of the great important subjects of our time. And so the music has to be serious to this story, and the darkness and the ways that people behave. But whenever you get close with human stories, obviously human stories are multi-dimensional.
I mean, some of it's, you know, funny.
It's absurd. It's ridiculous. And the moment to moment, the trivialities and the hatreds and the, you know, the feuds and the petty, I mean, all these things that are human, you have to laugh, you know, because it is funny. And so one of the big questions that I had while I was working on it was this question of, like, what do you do with music if you're trying to both be funny at times or not harm the comedy,
right,
and also give due import to the
gravitas.
So the way that this is my own experimenting with it, was that if the music ever got funny, it was not funny. Like, it actually felt really dorky and harmed the comedy. But whenever I made the music even more serious, that's when it felt really funny. So so when I needed to be serious, I was serious. And when I needed to be funny, I was even more serious.
Wow, because that adds the humor and absurdity.
Exactly. I mean, and the degree of, like, it's almost like the difference between what you're hearing and what you're seeing is so huge that you just have to laugh. It
makes me wonder about some of the funny scenes. Now I want to go back and listen. Scored? I don't know why the one
music series
comes up is where.
Anything with Greg, basically.
It's anything with Greg. I was just thinking of one.
Well, Greg actually, there's like a hip hop track of mine that plays when you see Greg at times, and it's not always with him, but the piece is this track Power that's on the soundtrack, and it's this instrumental hip hop track that, you know, it. I think the counterpoint of hearing that with Greg,
it's
just
so
makes,
badass.
Makes me,
and he's such a goofball.
He's like, you know, shredding these dogs. He has no idea what he's doing. So those are, you know, there's that. But to go back to the story of the theme track. So I had those initial ideas. Then from that meeting with Jesse, I started exploring this dark, classical oriented harmonic soundscape. You know, and what I found interesting with that too is that, like, it was very specific. Like, there's a sound to that era. There's certain chord progressions, certain nuances of the style of that time. It's not early classical. It's not the Romantic era of classical. It's really sort of like, you know, late 1700s or something like that. And I've always loved that sound world. So, but it was funny how certain things just didn't sound right either. It wasn't like, oh, just write classical sounding music. Some stuff did not sound right.
Well, also, they're in contemporary or reasonably contemporary New York City with glassy buildings and high-tech
stuff. So it was very
stuff.
Hardcore. I was hardcore with myself, like, what felt right. I remember even for season two, there were certain... I remember writing stuff that I thought was really cool, and then I was like, you know, it just sounds too something. It just didn't sound like the Roys, you know?
Was there a cue in the pilot that sounded like the theme, and somebody said, you know, this could be our theme?
Well, actually, we temped the pilot with me. I was involved early on. That was one of the things that Adam did, was he said, you know, he brought me on before they had shot it. And one of the nice things was I actually wrote while we were doing, the way it usually works with pilots is, you know, you work on the pilot and you get it pretty far along, and then the studio, you know, or will decide, do they want this to go to series? And then once that decision happens, you'll then go and you'll actually finish the show and probably go do production on the rest of the episodes. But even on the pilot that we did, we fleshed the ideas out really fully. I mean, some of the pieces that are in the finished season one were done just me and Adam trying out ideas. There's a culmination piece in the end of the pilot episode that builds that's I don't think that exact version is on the soundtrack. It's a piano version of one of the pieces that's on the soundtrack. But that was something that I did with Adam, actually, again, just in the studio with Adam. You know, I was trying stuff out, and I felt it was those chords, but taken in a more sweeping kind of way and a more building kind of a way. And so the you know, to cut to the chase of this, it's that the after I finished scoring the whole 10 episodes of season one, I had left this 90-second opening blank just because I everyone was into the theme idea. Everyone was into the piano, the sort of, and I can talk about how I made those things, but the actual track itself didn't exist. And mm-hmm. I didn't know which, you know, what, like I had an idea for the A section, which I thought was going to be this idea, this piano, the sort of winding piano idea. But the B section, I wasn't exactly sure. There was one theme idea I thought, but I didn't know how it would sound. I actually was playing with piano, but it didn't feel right. I didn't want it to be piano, and then you have a B section with piano, and then, you know, that didn't feel right. So it was, I think it took the full scope of the season one before I had the sense of like, oh, let me synthesize this together. And then I did it actually pretty quickly. It just sort of came together. But
that's so backwards of what I thought the story was going to be. Because it seems like you created the main title and then all of these variations came off of that. But it's so completely backwards from what I thought.
The chord progression, so all the individual elements of that existed in sort of different ways. So the chord progression became very featured. Some of that winding piano was its own thing, and then I did variations on that. The 808s and the beats was, you know, so all those elements existed in their own way. But they weren't all in one kind of place
and
yet.
Fabulous culmination of it is you won the Emmy for best main title.
Yeah, it's crazy.
All of these cracked versions of how you
different
got to a destination
and, yeah, exactly.
ends up with that thing you have to get through customs or it's the TSA.
Have to figure that out. Yeah, we
can't go without talking about your path into this, and we like to do this with a lot of our guests. You went to Harvard. Was film music like on the radar from an early point in your life, or do you have family that's in the biz? Like, what's your starting point with film music?
So when I first started playing the piano, I was 5 years old, and the reason I started playing the piano was because I saw Chariots of Fire,
nice.
And I was obsessed with Chariots of Fire, and I thought the score was amazing. I mean, I didn't know what a score was, but I loved that.
I
want to
put an
music.
Asterisk on this reference, because strangely enough, I hadn't thought of this until you mentioned it. The Succession theme, which is kind of a contemporary rhythm track mm-hmm. with a piano over it, mm-hmm. not entirely far conceptually, musically very different from the Chariots of Fire.
That's interesting.
Theme,
there's like a piano and a beat and a rhythm.
And so it got under your DNA somehow of
Vangelis is a genius. I mean,
that's
the
so
music,
rare.
The music
not enough
that
people
he,
give him props.
Oh my God, he's a genius. That the sound worlds that he created, and the thing too is, I've always loved melodic ideas. You know, I think it's one of the hardest things to distill, maybe. But there are certain composers through history, you know, whether you're talking about a Paul McCartney or a Schubert, who have this insight, and he does. You know, Vangelis had that ability to coalesce ideas into both a rhythmic and melodic kind of place.
But
and
there
it's
had,
beautiful.
There had to be a distance, because we have to get to the fact that you ended up, even though you heard Vangelis and yeah. knew you were musical, I can't remember exactly, but I know that you became an expert in currency, which might have been a diversion from your path.
Well, I'll tell you the quick story was basically I asked my mom for piano lessons after I, you know, heard the Chariots of Fire score and started, you know, learning piano. And I really seriously considered being a concert pianist. That was my whole, you know, childhood was playing the piano, and I gave my first public concert when I was 10, you know, so I was like very in that zone, and I love playing the piano and I love classical music. I went to Juilliard for the pre-college division while I was in high school.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Manhattan.
And then
we moved to Westport, Connecticut when I was 13, and so we were there.
Did you commute?
I would commute on Saturdays and then sometimes during the week for lessons as well, but it's a Saturday program at Juilliard. And I met, you know, actually I met so many of my closest friends to this day and people I still work with. And I actually met my wife through Juilliard pre-college as well.
A cellist.
Caitlin Sullivan, yeah. An amazing cellist. And we met actually at the Aspen Music Festival right after pre-college graduation.
I mean, the question would be, why didn't you go to Juilliard?
I thought about that. You know, I think I was, like anyone, I guess, to some extent, you know, when you're in high school, you don't know how the world works really. And I had a lot of different interests. I always loved music. But I don't think I had a sense of exactly how I would explore music for myself. I loved movies and, you know, the funny thing is in hindsight, like honing in on the things that you deeply love that just feel so connected to you in some way, those are the things maybe we should all be doing. Yeah. But that's only in hindsight. I mean, at the time I was like, of course I love film music, but how do you even do that? What do you do? You know? And when I went to Harvard, I actually had a really hard freshman year. I couldn't figure out what to do with myself. And I took a year off after freshman year to, you know, explore the piano and try to get, and basically say to myself, do I want to be a concert pianist and, you know, giving concerts. And, I was a cocktail pianist as well,
nice.
You know? And when I came back from that year off, I knew I wanted to be in a band. That was something I really wanted to be in a band. And coincidentally or serendipitously, a very dear friend of mine, Nick Lavelle, who tragically passed away a few years ago, who's an amazing director. He was making his first feature film in college while we were there. And he said, do you want to score this movie? And so I was like, of course, I'd love to try that. I had no idea what that entailed.
Sure.
But I'd watched movies obsessively for my whole life and always studied, you know, just unconsciously was always studying the music. My little brother and I were obsessed with film music when we were growing up, you know. So that was my college experience then was very focused on, I was in a hip hop band and called the Witness Protection Program with some very good friends. Where I was instrumental hip hop. We had two rappers and then six instrumentalists. So it was really a very live, hip hop band. And then I was scoring my friend's movie and experimenting. And then I actually had another friend, James Cox, who had made a documentary, and he asked me to score that. So it was just this process of trying things out and having no idea how you did anything, but I bought a Korg Triton keyboard.
Cool.
I still use that as my controller in my studio to this day. I love that keyboard. And I just, you know, I would use the sequencer. And this was, I had no Pro Tools, nothing. I would just like use the sequencer. And I ended up writing like a 3-hour orchestra score that was all, you know, synthesized basically for this movie. But it was such a great experience to do that. And then the detour into some currency trading was at the end of college, the band was breaking up, unfortunately. And I thought the movie would come out, but wasn't yet figuring out how that would happen. And I actually got hired by someone who I wanted to live in New York, and I was I had a very good friend who worked in finance, and he introduced me to someone who himself was a composer who said, you know, you seem like we could, you know, seem halfway, you know, smart, and we could figure something out. He literally said, "We'll figure something out for you to do." I mean, I thought for like 6 months, you know, I'll sort of, you know, have this cool job, and then I was like, "Oh, but you know, this movie's gonna come out, and you know, figure that out. It'd be great, you know."
Kind of job was this?
I started trading currencies, and I learned all about how you do that, and I would, you know, travel and do research, and I mean, it was very interesting, you know. I mean, it was a great education, but the more that I worked in New York, the more I wanted to do music full time. And actually, I got very, you know, got to a place where I was very unhappy because I wasn't focused on what I loved. And I was scoring friends' short films. You know, I was playing the piano a lot. I would give concerts, you know, for people. And I did a lot of, I would basically do anything. I mean, I wrote like telephone hold music. I would do anything.
So your job allowed you to live in Manhattan.
Yes.
But you hated doing it over time, but it was basically putting you in position for all this other musical work. So it was kind of a double-edged sword.
Exactly. So I was saving my money. I bought a piano, you know, I had always wanted to have a Steinway. So I bought a Steinway and I was building a studio but it was harder and harder, I think, just on a personal level there was a greater divergence between what I wanted to do and what I was able to do during the day. And so I quit my job and I just started coming out to LA and, you know, just trying to have coffee with people and say, "Hey, you know, anyone's looking for any music for anything, you know." And I did a lot of short films. I loved working on short films. I had some very dear friends who were themselves directors or producers who were working and trying to themselves, you know, build their careers in Hollywood. And early on, you know, it's really through just the support and friendships of people who believe in you, who say, "Yeah, you know, let's try this out." So a very dear friend of mine, Adam Leon, directed a movie called Give Me the Loot. And he that was really the first indie feature that I scored that went through the festival circuit. And, you know, those opportunities where you do that and then you get to see how the industry really works. Mm. You get to go into the festivals, I think, was always such a fantastic experience, because you meet other people, you know, you meet more of the community of people who are all trying to figure this out together. We're all just trying to figure this out. You know, there's no right way to do this, no one way. And then, you know, things go from one thing to another, but that was it was definitely a circuitous path. And I feel more connected to what I do now than I ever have in my life. And that's the thing I think that I feel when I'm composing, which is there's something about if you love music, writing music and writing something that you feel, and then that other people can then share that feeling, is a very special experience.
And ironically, I was the beneficiary of your currency knowledge, because Nick and I had the opportunity to work on a picture overseas together.
It's true.
And I think I was going to change some dollars at like a, you know, either an airport exchange place, Cambio, whatever. And Nick said very sagely,
"Don't do that.
You're walking up to the counter like,
right." Right.
I'm gonna get this.
I'm gonna give you $200. Let me have some euros.
They're like, "Here's $3, sir."
Right. And right. I think, if I'm not mistaken, and now of course this shows how my retention is, I think one of your suggestions was that it's actually better to go to a cash machine with a Visa card.
Yeah, you get a much better exchange rate if you do it from an ATM than if you do
Score the podcast.
I was going to say.
Yeah. Yeah. There's additional commissions that they take out from the
I love
the,
that you scored a movie exchange, called Give Me the Loot.
That was my first first indie feature. Give Me the Loot. Yeah.
And that we've gotten in the Nick Bertel episode to, you know, how when you go overseas.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're going to get you on next season. We'll do a whole financial advisor.
Sure, yeah.
I think we'd be remiss before we finish up without sharing the fact that I had the great privilege of hiring Nick to do the interstitial music on a, God bless him, slightly bizarre motion picture that to this day I'm not sure has ever been released, which can happen. And it was because I was looking at 12 Years a Slave, which you said you had worked on, and I wondered who did the period music, that was really interesting, and I mentioned it to someone who said, oh, I know Nick Britell. You guys should meet. And Nick, something you referred to earlier today, said that period, because the movie we worked on took place during the reign of, correct me if I'm wrong, it was one of the Louis, the 16th?
14th.
14th, thank you, I was close. That might be why the movie didn't work. I thought it was the 16th the whole time. It was Louis the 14th, and Nick said, I know that period cold, and I know what kind of instruments they would play, and the girl in the movie is a cellist, and Nick says cellos weren't invented. But they played a...
There were cellos, but there would have been different kinds of... We actually
tell
wound
me, did
up,
we find one?
We ended up creating an instrument for it, I remember.
We made an instrument, of course. This is all the effort that goes into a movie that nobody ever knows about. We created it. But I think, with all due respect to the filmmakers, the great joy of that project was we got to spend some real quality time at Versailles in France. They put us up at a beautiful hotel. We had to shoot between 6 p.m. and dawn, because the tourists came every day at 6:30 a.m., and we had a masterful hang.
I loved hanging with you, Rob. It was incredible. It was incredible. Those were really some of the most memorable experiences. I mean,
it was,
you know,
a blast.
We got to jam together a little bit.
Did we?
I have a great photo of you sitting at a harp inside of
Versailles. I think it was a prop.
I think it was a beautiful harp. Yeah, I love that.
I'll send you that. We'll post that on
It's a great picture.
And I think the really memorable photo from this, which I thought would be kind of fun to send to the producer who had hired me, and then I hired you, while we were shooting at 6, you know, we're now at 3 a.m. in the morning, we're shooting music scenes, and it's just crazy. We're in Versailles in the Hall of Mirrors, and it's a movie crew in there, and we're shooting these scenes. And I, you know, long time between takes. And so I kind of sneak down a hallway while they're getting ready for the next take. And I found Louis XIV's bedroom, which was in Versailles. It was down a hallway and down this other hallway. And it was roped off for the tourists. You could go a certain distance into the room, but there were red ropes. I thought, it's 3 a.m.
Take
Nobody's
a nap?
Here.
You napped on Louis XIV's bed?
I got into Louis
bed?
XIV's bed.
I can't believe this.
And I took a selfie.
I can't believe this. You have that photo?
Not only did I have the photo.
It's contraband.
I thought it'd be a good idea to send it to the producer.
Oh, that's...
Saying, hey, man.
Probably not.
This is, and he, I would say, flipped out. Would, you know, we'd be arrested in France. That's like...
There's extradition papers being dropped. Right.
The
right
one
now.
Question, though.
Yes.
Did you make the bed?
I did make the bed. I left it a little crumpled. In fact, today, if you go to Versailles and look at
sacrilege.
Louis XIV,
this is sacrilege.
You see the indent.
Oh. And they're like, that's where Louis last rested.
That's it.
This is a photo of Robert Kraft.
But I also thought, you know, Louis XIV was a guy, this is more information that no one needs, who was infamous for, he had a lot of women housed in Versailles.
Oh, boy.
In the East Wing. So that when the sun came up,
oh my God,
the Sun King, who Louis XIV was, they would see the sun when they pulled their curtains open and be reminded of him. And I thought, I'm going to lie in this bed, get some energy, take a selfie. Hey, man, you know, you and me, Louis XIV, we're bonding over 400 years. The producer didn't see it that way for some reason. He thought, you're going to get this movie shut down and kicked out.
You're forever going to be known as Robert the 14th now.
I like really. That. The Sun King, sort of. Anyhow,
oh,
what a great
man.
Project
what
that
a,
was.
What a, I think that's a great way to close this episode out.
Nick Britell in the house telling us so much.
You left your lonely Emmy. She's all by herself at the hotel room. We want
all
to let
back
you get
at
back
the
to her.
At the hotel room. I have to figure out how to, I'll figure out how to bring it back.
Yeah, I think, boy, would be, you know, it'd be great to post a photo of you with a TSA agent.
Actually, yeah, if I figure out this process, yes.
Are you back to New York soon?
I'm working here a bit this week, and then I'm back next week.
Right
yeah.
on.
Awesome. Yeah.
Well, I
yeah.
know we've been trying to get you on the show, and it couldn't have happened at a more perfect time because you just won the freaking Emmy.
Crazy. Yeah. Crazy.
Best of luck to
Thank
everything
so
in
much.
The future,
Thank
and
you.
We really
Thank
appreciate you.
You
coming on all the way from New York City. We want to remind our listeners to rate and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts, and click subscribe, and also stick around after the end of this show. We're going to play you a demo cue from Spitfire so you can hear how to elevate your music. Robert.
And I just have to say, as Nick always says to me, respect.
Respect.
R-E-S-P-E-C-T. Nick Britell, thanks so much. We will see you next week.
Thanks
see you
for
next
having week. Me here.
Hey, Score listeners, the whole team is here. Say hello, everyone.
Hey.
Hey.
Hi.
We're very excited about the partnership we have with Spitfire Audio, our presenting partner. So many of the composer guests we have on love the products, and we were able to share this promo code with you to save a third off Score if you use that in the checkout. And yeah. They give us a cue every week to play you, so you can hear some of the examples of the different types of instruments that you can get in the different packages.
And this is music they've produced with these packages that they Correct. Have available.
Yeah. And they have the different packages. There's the Albion 1. There's now the BBC Symphony that's coming Ooh, out yeah. at the end of October. So a lot of different things to choose from. And use our promo code SCORE to save a third off. How much, Robert?
33 1/3%.
That's a lot.
That's like 3 times tax or more, depending on where you live. That's a lot. That's a big savings. So check out this cue. You can get all sorts of different sounds like the ones you just heard. Go to spitfireaudio.com, use the promo code SCORE, save a third off, and we will see you next week.
Next week. Can't wait.
See ya.